This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 19, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. Democratic leaders of Congress vow to take on global warming as a top priority this year. The Senate passes an ethics reform bill, but does it go far enough towards preventing corruption? Plus, we'll hear from the indigenous Bennett community in their struggle to keep their ancestral lands in Uganda. All that and more on today's newscast, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. An outspoken Turkish-Armenian newspaper editor was gunned down today outside of his office in Istanbul. The editor, Hrant Dink, had previously received death threats for refusing to deny that the Ottoman Empire carried out a campaign of genocide against Armenians in the early part of the 20th century. Dink had faced a number of court cases for his writings and last year was even convicted of insulting Turkishness for an article he published about World War I-era massacres of Armenians. Historians calculate that over 1 million Armenians died in the death campaigns. Turkey's refusal to recognize the Armenian genocide and its tight restrictions on freedom of expression have both led to objections from EU member states regarding Turkey's bid to enter the European Union. Residents of Baghdad woke up to a curfew today as Iraqi security forces prepare to implement a new security operation against Shiite militias. Hiba Dawood reports.
Iraqi police arrested today Abdelhadi Darraji, a high-profile figure in the movement led by Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, along with six of his guards. One of the guards was killed during the arrest. Fearing demonstrations after Friday prayers, authorities declared a curfew in Baghdad until 3 p.m. local time. North of Baghdad, in the city of Kirkuk, insurgents shot and killed the sheikh and imam of the Ibrahim al-Khalil Mosque while he was on his way home. In Karbala and Najaf, south of Baghdad, authorities have set up emergency measures in preparation for the celebration of Shi'at Holy Month Muharram. Iraqi President Jalal Talabani has just returned to Baghdad from a visit to Syria. Upon his arrival, Talabani announced that Syria promises to hand over wanted fugitive figures hiding in the country to the Iraqi authorities. Meanwhile, Harith al-Ubaidi, a member of the Human Rights Committee of the Iraqi Parliament, has announced that over 33,000 Iraqis are currently being held in Iraqi and American prisons. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Hiba Dawood reporting.
The Pentagon has published its new rulebook for trying terrorist suspects entitled The Manual for Military Commissions. Legal experts opposed to the military commissions have found that the new rules could allow for a suspect to be convicted or even sentenced to death solely on the basis of hearsay. Although the military commissions manual prohibits the use of evidence obtained through torture, statements obtained through coercion can be used in the trials. The new rules do not set minimum standards for evidence, instead leave it up to a military judge to decide what is admissible. A truck driver involved in the nation's deadliest human smuggling attempt will spend the rest of his life in jail. From Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
Federal prosecutors came to Texas for their first attempt to secure a death sentence in a human smuggling case. They told jurors how in May of 2003, Tyrone Williams smuggled over 70 Mexican and Central American men, women, and children in his truck's airtight trailer. As temperatures rose in the trailer, migrants clawed at insulation and knocked out taillights to allow air in and to scream for help. Williams abandoned the trailer at a truck stop about 100 miles southwest of Houston. 19 victims died from overheating, dehydration, and suffocation. Jurors spent 4.5 days deliberating Williams' punishment, beginning each session with a 19-second pause in memory of the victims. They handed down 19 life sentences with no possibility of parole. Williams was the only participant in the smuggling ring to face death. Jurors told reporters he was the last link in a long supply chain. Some legal analysts argue the federal government's failure to secure a death sentence will prevent them from pursuing similar convictions in future smuggling cases. After the trial, Williams' attorney called for immigration reform and said he plans to appeal. In Houston, Texas, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
This week, one of Colombia's top paramilitary commanders resumed his confession of crimes against humanity as part of a deal that reduces the prison sentences of paramilitary chiefs. Nicole Carson reports from Bogota.
The AUC paramilitary group is responsible for some of Colombia's worst massacres and political violence in the past 40 years. Currently, under Colombia's peace and justice law, instead of serving a maximum of 50 years, paramilitaries who confess to crimes will serve a maximum of 8 years. AUC leader Salvatore Mancuso has mostly confessed to having a role in cases already dismissed by the Colombian justice system, like the horrific Maparipan massacre, in which the AUC slaughtered 50 peasants. While speaking of the AUC's relationship with key members of the Colombian armed forces, Mancuso conveniently mentioned names of people already deceased or convicted. Victims, who watched the confession on a closed-circuit court TV, were hoping to find the location of the remains of their loved ones, information that has not yet been revealed. Like other paramilitary leaders, Mancuso has been able to avoid extradition to the U.S. on drug trafficking charges in exchange for his testimony. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nicole Carson in Bogota.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The House passed legislation last night that would roll back tax breaks given to oil companies. The money will be reinvested in renewable energy initiatives. Democratic leaders of Congress vow that independence from foreign oil and combating global warming will be top priorities this year, along with Iraq. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Democrats are drafting various forms of legislation to reduce global warming. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
We will continue robust research on global warming and produce policies that reduce greenhouse gas emissions while simultaneously creating good-paying jobs. We want to work with President Bush on this important issue in a bipartisan way, but we cannot afford to wait. Therefore, with openness and the participation of all parts of our democracy, we will pass groundbreaking legislation that addresses global warming and energy independence.
Yesterday, the House took the first step by removing fiscal incentives from oil companies and gave them to renewable energy initiatives. Speaker Pelosi also created a special committee on global warming. That committee won't have authority to write legislation, but it will have one mission: to stop climate change. And it will direct legislators on the best way to do so. Representative Ed Markey, Democrat of Massachusetts, will lead that committee. And the Senate is just as ambitious. Majority Leader Harry Reid.
Each of my chairs stood and talked about what they're going to do in their committees. Senator Inouye, for example, in Commerce, said he's going to move forward on CAFE standards. Senator Lieberman, Government Affairs, said he was going to make sure that the federal fleet, which is the largest in the world, 700,000 vehicles, not counting the military, we buy 60,000 vehicles a year. He's going to work to make those green, those vehicles. And then finally, Senator Boxer stood and said, 39% of the greenhouse gases in America are produced by buildings. The largest holder of real estate in America is the General Services Administration. The building should be green. So we're moving forward in a number of different fronts.
Senator Barbara Boxer, chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee, and freshman senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, introduced legislation this week that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2050. Those are the same standards as California's. And she has a number of hearings scheduled to address ways to do it. David Creedman is with the Union of Concerned Scientists. He says that 80% reduction is a phenomenal goal, but the strategy must be comprehensive in order to do it.
Well, no matter how a climate bill is structured, you need to make sure that electric utilities reduce their global warming pollution. We can no longer rely on the 18th century fuel of coal as our main power source. We need to make sure that electric utilities increase the amount of renewable electricity they use. But we also need to make sure that we don't leave out cars and trucks and 18-wheelers and planes and ships. Some of the times when people talk about policies to approach global warming, they look at maybe one sector or the other sector should take the burden. At the end of the day, all of us are responsible for this problem. The United States produces about 25% of the world's global warming pollution. And whether you're at home, in industry, driving a car, making a car, or generating electricity, you need to be part of the solution, not part of the problem.
In addition to the Boxer bill, which is the most ambitious, three other pieces of legislation are out there to combat global warming. One of them is bipartisan. But opposition could be fierce. Former chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee, James Inhofe, doesn't believe in global warming. He said he'll fight any effort to cap emissions. President Bush is expected to talk about global warming as a priority in his State of the Union address next Tuesday. It probably will not include a cap on emissions, and rather would likely talk about an emphasis on nuclear and clean coal technology. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Former Representative Bob Ney, Republican from Ohio, was sentenced to 2.5 years in jail and ordered to pay a $6,000 fine for his part in the Jack Abramoff lobbying corruption scandal. Ney pled guilty to accepting tens of thousands of dollars worth of trips, drinks and meals, and tickets to music and sporting events in exchange for political favors to Abramoff. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the Senate's passed an ethics reform bill after a 2-day stalemate because Republican members wanted to attach the line item veto to the measure. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid this morning, 12 hours after the vote.
We were not going to deal with line item veto on that piece of legislation, and we would not discuss line item veto until we finished this bill. And that was the beginning of our negotiations, and that led to our accomplishing this. Legislation is, as I said in my prepared remarks, the most significant change in ethics and lobbying reforms in the history of the country. And I'm very happy with the Senate for having done this, Democrats and Republicans.
The bill passed 96-2. Meals, trips, and other gifts from lobbyists will no longer be allowed, and lobbyists will have to certify that they've met the terms of the gift ban. We're joined by Mary Boyle, Press Secretary for Common Cause. The House has already moved to change some lobbying standards. What can we expect to see there? What's the final legislation going to look like in conference?
The House and Senate, as you point out, have passed slightly different bills. The heart of them are quite similar. And what is next is this will have to go into a conference committee, and they will have to agree on, the House and the Senate will have to agree on the provisions. We do expect a very strong package that will go a very good way towards, reining in some of the corruption that we've seen in recent years on Capitol Hill.
What kind of change do you think that this is going to have on the face of lobbying? In other words, will grassroots groups, for example, finally have a chance in the future to get their issues heard?
Well, I think that, I don't think it's going to completely certainly change the lobbying industry in Washington as we know it. I think a lot of this depends on the enforcement of these rules, whether they move forward and do create an independent enforcement commission, which is something that we strongly advocate. We think these are great reforms, but that they need to go basically that extra step to make sure that these rules are enforced.
And what's that extra step going to take? Do you think that will actually happen?
Well, the extra step is a hard one, and it's a difficult one. There was an amendment last night that the Senate did vote down that would have created an independent outside ethics commission. We will be pushing for both the House and the Senate to revisit that because we just feel like without the enforcement entity, there's not enough teeth to prevent some of the problems that we've seen for the last few years.
Mary Boyle is the press secretary for Common Cause. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights last month found Peru's government, under former President Alberto Fujimori, responsible for the deaths of 41 people in a jail in one incident and the assassination of 9 students and 1 teacher in another. FSRN's Pamela Cueva and Alfredo Cuadros filed this report from Lima, Peru.
In May 1992, military forces entered the Castro jail in Lima and confronted detained members of guerrilla organization Shining Path, provoking a massive riot. When the attack was over, 41 prisoners were there, including 13 of the most important leaders of Shining Path. The Inter-American Commission of Human Rights now requires the Peruvian government to investigate the murder of the 41 prisoners at Castro in order to identify and punish those responsible. In addition, the government must compensate the relative of the victims within the next 18 months and publicly acknowledge its responsibility in a violation of prisoners' right to life. Miguel Hugo, the executive director of APRODE, a Peruvian Association for Protecting Human Rights, explains.
Hay hechos que señalan que Alberto Fujimori estuvo conduciendo.
There are facts that show that Alberto Fujimori was conducting the military action. Therefore, he knew about it, and for sure, the order to kill the people who were gathering came from him and the group that led the action. Secondly, it is clear that the action did not have as its main purpose the relocation of the political prisoners. They were coming out with their arms raised when the extrajudicial executions took place, the rape of a woman, and the sexual attacks against six of them.
Autopsies revealed that the convicts were killed by shot to the head and chest. They were shot at close range. They are executioners standing behind the victims. The commission concludes that the invading officers have no intention of immobilizing the prison. Alfredo Pocorpachi, a witness to the attack, shares his experiences.
We heard them shout, "We are coming out," and they were waving white pieces of clothing as a surrender signal. Our relatives came out of the main door of Pavilion 4B, crossing the courtyard, walking in groups, hugging each other, and singing their political slogans. Then we only heard shooting. Nobody wanted to explain to us what was happening, but we assumed the worst.
Julia Peña, mother of two prisoners victims of the attacks, recalls what happened in the jail.
My daughter was 27 years old, and she was shot in the head when she was surrounded. She was studying in the university and had been accused of belonging to the Shining Path. My son was wounded by 5 bullets, and the military officer took him to the morgue. Now he lives with 2 bullets, one in his stomach and the other one in his left leg. He is serving a sentence of 20 years.
An investigation conducted by the Division of Criminal Investigation between 2002 and 2004 also found that the President Alberto Fujimori and the highest police and military authorities committed homicide in Castro jail. During a separate incident in July 1992, a paramilitary group known as Colina kidnapped and murdered Hugo Muñoz and 9 of his students at the Enrique Guzmán Valle University, popularly known as La Cantuta. Colina claimed Muñoz and his students were subversive. The Peruvian Congress at the time granted amnesty to the perpetrators of the attack, and the group's commander, Santiago Martín Rivas, was promoted. Inter-American Commission found that the rights to life and freedom of Muñoz and the other 9 were violated by the state. It ordered the government to complete an investigation into the murders to bring those responsible for these crimes to trial. As with the Castro jail murders, the commission has called for a public act of recognition to victims' relatives. Current Peruvian President Alan Garcia has rejected the findings of the commission. He argues that the government should not be submitted to the commission's sentence. Garcia says it was a serious mistake of the former government to leave these cases to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to judge. The Peruvian president has also expressed his refusal to build a monument honoring all the victims of the violent times, who included, in Garcia's words, the guerrilla members who deserve to die. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights also calls for the extradition of Alberto Fujimori from Chile, as he is considered the intellectual perpetrator of these crimes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros in Lima, Peru.
Catholic-run hospitals in Australia are refusing to give the morning after pill to women who have been sexually assaulted. Catholic-controlled hospital organizations run more than 70 hospitals in Australia. 21 of those are public hospitals tended out by state governments and as such receive government funding. But the Catholic health sector is growing, with the addition of another hospital just last week. Catholic Health Australia has defended its policy, saying the church has never allowed anything which condoned abortions in its hospitals. But doctors, politicians, and community groups are concerned about the effect such a policy has on traumatized women. And now there's cause for a Senate inquiry. FSRN's Cinnamon Napard has more from Sydney.
Australian Democrats leader and health spokesperson Lynn Allison.
It's not up to them to make moral judgments about abortion for women who don't hold the same faith as they do. If you're not a Catholic woman and you see no particular objection to abortion, then you should be entitled, since it's within the law, to access both abortion and emergency contraception.
President of the Australian Medical Association, Dr. Mukesh Haikerwal, says the problem of providing health services and taking into account different religious beliefs is a difficult one.
It's very important that people have their beliefs and stick to them and are allowed to practice their faith in the way that they feel is right. Similarly, hospital management, but patients need to have access to alternative sources of care And that becomes more of a problem when you're moving away from capital cities where the number of hospitals around is limited. However, people need to be aware that the choices are available for them. And if the hospital or the doctor concerned is unable to provide it themselves, then they need to be able to be pointed in the direction so that other people can provide those services.
Kevin Sullivan from Catholic Health Australia says that assaulted women are given appropriate medical and emotional care in Catholic-run hospitals, as well as information about other services. It's just that they can't provide the morning after pill. But manager of the New South Wales Rape Crisis Centre, Karen Willis, says this policy puts another hurdle in front of an already traumatised person.
As it stands, a person who's been sexually assaulted already has to consider, you know, going to Department of Health, where they will see counsellors in one location, forensic medical people in another location, maybe pathologists in another location, quite possibly medical treatment in another location. They also have to think about going to police, and they also have to think about talking to family and friends, just breathing, getting out of bed the next day and working towards recovery. There's already enough for them to do to say, oh, yes, we're providing the information, but they can go off to another location again somewhere and say, hi, I'm the sexual assault victim, I want the morning after pill because, and then get a script and then go down the road to another chemist or whatever to get it. I think it's just adding trauma to someone who's already traumatised, and I think it's highly unethical.
CEO of Catholic Health Australia, Kevin Sullivan, says the Catholic stance on reproductive issues is well known and it shouldn't be up to them to provide services which are against their ethics.
The real issue here is that if state governments and territory governments in Australia wish to make available abortion services, then it's up to them to provide them. It's not up to the Catholic Church.
Willis from the New South Wales Rape Crisis Centre says there are standard treatment procedures that hospitals and NGOs abide by when treating sexual assault victims, which includes counselling, forensic tests and the option of the morning after pill.
It's saying to the Catholic services, either you abide by this or you don't provide services to victims of sexual assault. And it's also incumbent on governments when they're discussing with organisations like the Catholic Health Commission about running hospital services to check whether they're going to make all of those services available. If they're not, well, then they don't, you know, contract that service out to them.
Senator Lynn Allison, leader of the Australian Democrats and spokesperson on health, says there's a good argument for a Senate inquiry into Catholic health services for sexual assault. But she also says there could be further investigation into the whole area of reproductive services and Catholic health policy. For Free Speech Radio News in Sydney, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
The indigenous Bennett communities of Uganda live in the cold forest of the 440 square mile volcanic Mount Elgon National Park, which straddles the Kenya-Uganda border, as do the Bennett communities. In 2006, a Ugandan court ruled that the Bennetts on its side of the border have the right to remain on Mount Elgon. The long-sought judgment also obliges the Ugandan government to compensate the Bennett for damages suffered during government evictions. Despite their legal victory, the Bennetts of Uganda, like their kin in Kenya, still face eviction from the home they've inhabited for generations. The 7th Annual World Social Forum, which kicks off tomorrow in Nairobi, will address the issue of Uganda and Kenya's indigenous communities. FSRN's Joshua Chalimpa spoke to Bennett community members and files this report.
Long before the area was turned into a national park, the Bennetts have lived off the fruits of this land for generations while raising cattle to supplement their livelihoods.
The song I've just been dancing is of sorrows, because traditionally we, the indigenous people, used to own a lot of cows, and these cows used to feed us with the milk.
72-year-old Bennett elder Boyot Mwet has just won his freedom from the wildlife police, who arrested him for collecting bamboo trees he uses to make baskets.
They shot our children. The environment has been depleted. The first thing that government should recognize us as human beings, who deserves to be protected.
Instead, the government has ignored the court ruling and continues the relationship that was established by the British colonists Elder Ndua capturing, estimated to be 107 years old, has memories of a Bennett eviction by the British in the 1930s that left many members of his community dead when the colonialists attempted to remove them from the forests.
Even if government insists to evict us from here, for me, I don't accept, because this has been my motherland. We are just given by God. So it is better to die in this area of mine, because even if I'm taken to the other lower side, I think the environment there is very harsh, considering the altitude. So the government is better to kill me here or to die here, because I can no longer accept to move.
In 1936, the homeland of the Bennetts was declared a forest reserve, and in 1992, the governments of Kenya and Uganda declared the area a national park. Since then, the Bennetts have been living at the mercy of both governments, who in 2002 decided it was time for this indigenous community to leave the forests. The Bennetts, with the help of a local NGO, Uganda Land Alliance, and Action Aid International, went to court in 2003. And last year, the court decided in the Bennett's favor. Moses Kiptara is part of the Bennett community and a member of the Bennett Lobby Group.
What our consent judgment is stating is that, one, government recognizes that the Bennetts are the indigenous and the historical inhabitants of this place. And therefore, when they are historical and the indigenous inhabitants, they have a right to live in this place. Then the other thing which is mentioned by the consent judgment is government has an obligation to provide the social services in form of affirmative action.
Despite the ruling, the government has refused to respect the decision of court and continues to harass the Bennett. The Bennett have been driven from the high elevations of the mountain to the lowlands, and they say this has made life unbearable. They are not allowed to graze their animals in the park, and have resorted to battering their crops with nearby farming communities. Although this is also untenable, since the baskets are made from bamboo, which has to be obtained from the forest. Kokop Job explains the problems she faces as a basket maker.
When you go down there where people cultivate maize, you just exchange. They can just fill maize inside here, then that's how we can exchange. Otherwise, if you don't weave these baskets, at times you sleep without food because there is no food. The problem now is because we used to live near these bamboos up there, where the altitude is high. So when they evicted us and they forced us to live nearer to the Dauna people, we have had a problem in actually collecting these bamboos because it is restricted.
The Bennett also have to compete with other communities. The land which had been set aside for the Bennett has been taken over by other communities. Benache Bet, a community leader, explains.
When this land was given, it was only meant for the indigenous Bennett. But because we were illiterate, this resettlement went into the hands of other people. That's where we have now a serious conflict.
With the help of British Charity Action Aid International, the plight of the indigenous Bennett community will be discussed at the upcoming World Social Forum in Nairobi this month, where activists and members of the civil society will be meeting to campaign for a just world. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa in Bennett, Mountain Elgon.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News from KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Aura Bogado.